Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. Corey and Shad here, joined by Jeff Christian, managing partner at the CPM Group. Now, Jeff, I feel like ad nauseum we have talked about what the Fed might do, some banking issues in the U.S. and globally, and then what the gold price is going to do. Fact of the matter is, markets broadly are still trading in a pretty wide range, and when something breaks, well, then we'll cover it a bit more. Since the CPM Group works with so many larger mining companies, companies that are producing precious metals as well as some other commodities, I want to focus a little bit on some of the narrative that we have heard from a lot of the precious metals bulls saying, look, we're running into a supply crunch here where demand is much outstripping supply and there just aren't enough new mines coming on that could drastically change this precious metals market especially. Jeff, what are you hearing from the majors? Do the majors see a major supply shortage around the corner?
You know, I don't see the majors, or I don't hear the majors worrying about the world running out of mineable reserves and resources. I think the majors well understand that there's plenty of reserves and resources. What they're worried about is their own balance sheet. You know, if you're a large mining company, let's say you're producing 1 or 3 or 4 million ounces of gold a year, you need to find replacement reserves. First off, if you don't, you're just a depreciating asset. So, you know, if you're mining 3 million ounces a year, ideally you're adding 3 million or more ounces to your reserve base to replace that which you've just mined. In addition to that, the stock market always wants to see growing reserves, and they'll penalize you if your reserves are falling, you know. So the mining companies, the majors that we talk to about all this, they're not worried about the world running out of gold. What they're worried about is maintaining their reserve base and adding to it to, A, keep their company to be seen as a growing enterprise, and also to appease gold mining equity investors. So that's the things that we hear them talking about. I don't know major mining executives that think that the world's running out of mineable gold. And the same is true really in silver. I don't hear that discussion at that level in the industry.
Well, Jeff, to that point, a lot of these companies are sitting on reserves that they have to report quarterly to the marketplace, but they also have a lot of resources. And if people think back to the last cycle when things peaked out in 2010, 2011, a lot of these companies were buying growth of ounces just for the sake of growth, because that's what the market was demanding. That's what investors wanted. And they ended up sitting on a lot of ounces that were not profitable to pull out of the ground. So they're still in their resource base, but they're not really in reserves. As the metals prices have crept higher over the last few years, some of those have jumped categories as they've been able to move up their base metals price assumption. So maybe speak to, you know, what are you hearing as far as that's concerned, as far as what companies are sitting on or how are they going to get these new reserves?
Yeah, you know, the interplay between reserves and resources and the role of price in determining what's a resource and what's a reserve is very important, and it's not well discussed in the gold equity and silver equity space. But that's one of the big issues. I mean, you know, when the price of gold had dropped down to $1,200 from, say, 2013 through the first half of 2019, you know, a lot of companies had to lower the price that they were using to calculate what's a reserve and what's a resource to maybe $1,000, maybe even $900. And when they did that, then a lot of their reserves became resources. They were sub-economic at $1,000. They had been economic at $1,200 or $1,400. So you found their reserves being impaired by the price. Then, you know, after the first half of 2019, when the gold price went from $1,300 to $1,600 and then $1,800 and then $2,000, all of a sudden they are able to recalculate their reserves and take things that had been consigned to the resource segment of their assets and put it back in reserves. And reserves obviously have a higher value in the market's eyes than resources because they're profitably mineable at near or current or near current prices. So, you know, that price function comes in there. And, you know, one of the things you're seeing now is since 2019, a lot of the mining companies have revalued their reserves at $1,600 an ounce. And there are some companies that are saying, well, can we use or should we use $1,800 an ounce? And then, you know, equity regulators and bankers will say, no, you know, that's a little bit too aggressive. 1600, you know, is probably the number to use right now. But the price and price expectations factor in big time in the reserve calculations and resource calculations. And it's something that a lot of people overlook.
So, Jeff, that, I guess, could be another bump to the underlying resource base. But what about companies looking at acquisition? Do you find that the majors are still interested at taking out more earlier stage assets that have deposits around them? Or are they more focused on assets that are already built, so some of that cost is already taken care of?
Yeah, it's a very difficult thing. It's a sliding scale. You have, you know, at the lower end where you have earlier stage exploration and pre-development companies, you have a greater risk, but you pay less per ounce of inferred or implied resources. Then at the other end of the spectrum, if you've got companies that have done extensive drilling and maybe they've mined development, or maybe they're even either at the verge of going into production or in production, those guys will have measured and indicated reserves, which is more powerful to you for your balance sheet, but it's more expensive per ounce to buy that mining company because the reserves have been proven and are probable. They're proven and probable measured and inferred reserves. And so a mining company that's on the acquisition trail has to sort of say, well, you know, I want some sort of mix there. I want to pay for some of the lower price resources, but I also need to replace reserves. And again, then they're all on the lookout for replacement reserves because as they mine, they need to replace the reserves that they've been mining. So they don't want to buy too early stage of materials because they need to be able to show the stock market stable reserves.
Well, Jeff, and just talking with these larger companies, do you get the impression that they're more interested to acquire a development stage project that's near production or even a producing asset rather than going through the permitting process and social engagement process and high capital cost of building a mine on their own?
Yeah, well, you know, there are several more sets of issues there. Yeah, and yes, if you've gone through the permitting process, has become so difficult. Issues related to environmental impacts and permitting and getting social buy-in from the local groups and governments and proving that you're a good corporate citizen, those things have gotten to be much more painful and problematic to prove. So there is an advantage to buying a company or a mine from a company that has already been developed, has gone through the permitting process, has gotten buy-in from the local communities, so it's not as high of a risk, and you have a greater certainty that those reserves are there and can be mined rather than being tied up indefinitely by the permitting process and public hearings and local complaints about whether or not the mine should be built. So, you know, if you are buying an existing mine or a mine that has just recently started production, you are saving yourself a tremendous amount of pain, and you're reducing the uncertainty as to the timing of future production from that property enormously. So those are big advantages to going up the chain to buying companies that are either in production or near production.
Boy, have we ever heard just over the last couple of years how difficult it has been to build mines with the just consistent cost creep that we've had. Jeff, what about ounces in the ground, though? Because it was probably a decade ago, everyone was saying 1 million ounces in a good jurisdiction. That's what majors are looking for. The market values those more highly. That seems to have changed. It now seems like the market is looking for multiple million ounces in the ground in a good jurisdiction. I've even heard people say that majors want at least 5 million ounces or a pretty direct path to 5 million ounces. What, in your eyes, are majors looking for when it comes to simply analyzing a deposit size?
Well, I think part of that has to do with the capital costs and the development costs. Yeah, you know, a million ounce deposit is still a very attractive deposit, but you start looking at the need to replace reserves. If you're a 3 million ounce or a 2 million ounce a year producer, you need to find two things like that to buy every year. That's difficult. So if you can find a 5 million ounce deposit, you've got maybe 2.5 years worth of ore depletion covered. So you have a little bit of a benefit. So, and also you're defraying your capital costs over a larger number of ounces. So there's a lot of advantages to having bigger deposits. And strangely enough, there are bigger deposits being discovered. You know, you'll hear that the mining industry, not just gold, but mining in general, is not finding big deposits and high-grade deposits the way they used to. And to some extent, that's true, but to some extent, it is not a reflection that those deposits don't exist. It's a reflection of the way that the exploration programs at mining companies have changed. And they're being perhaps less efficient, and they're doing less field research and more computer-generated geological exploration, which has a lower discovery rate than the field work. So you've got a lot of issues there that are kicking in. And obviously, if you can find a bigger property, you know it's better than finding a smaller property. But in addition to that, you know, it's not necessarily true that we've discovered all the big properties and big deposits and big generative areas. I mean, I was at the PDAC last week, and I attended a session about a very large new, it's been known for more than a century, but it's never really been mined, a very large gold district that several mining companies now are working on exploring and doing pre-development work and delineating ore bodies in. So, you know, the stuff is out there. It just hasn't been discovered.
Yeah, Jeff, and we talk to companies every week where they're putting out updated resource estimates, and it seems like they keep growing it from 1 million to 2 million to 3 million. Some of these companies have 6, 8 million, pushing 10 million now. So there are companies that are finding not just gold, but silver and copper. And it seems like there are discoveries that are still happening. But I got a question about jurisdiction, because it seems like a lot of those new discoveries are happening in South America, where there's some political concerns, or in West Africa, where the majors used to be more active and they've kind of pulled in their horns. Do you notice when you're in conversations a trend to get into safer jurisdictions again? Because it seems like a lot of the majors are now consolidating back into the U.S. and in Canada and leaving some of the areas that are further afield, where the trend maybe 5 to 10 years ago was to go into those emerging areas. Any thoughts on jurisdictions?
Well, there's several things that are going on. And yeah, you know, there is a re-emphasis on safer, less politically risky jurisdictions, and also mining closer to home and, you know, in less remote and inhospitable physical situations. But the first point I would make is, if you look, you know, you go back over 200 years of gold mining and exploration and discovery, you know, Northern California and the Australian outback and the South African bushveld and Nevada, those are all remote, hostile places to go look for gold. And gold was discovered there. And gold was basically discovered in geological anomalies where people who had found earlier gold mines said, oh, well, gold should not exist in that geological setting, but it does. And it does in large volume. You know, so when people start talking about the physical remoteness and difficulty there today, it's like, hey, it's always been that way, at least since the 1840s, right? So So that's one thing. The second thing is the rise in resource nationalism, which makes it more difficult to mine and puts a greater political risk in mining in Latin America or Africa or other places. And, you know, a lot of the political risk, I think it's changing a little bit now. We used to do a lot of political risk analysis. And the problem is that most political risk analysis goes out 5 years. But you're talking about a mine with a mine life of, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years or longer. Yeah. And the political risk analyses of the next 5 years doesn't really cover the potential risks of regime change over 4 decades. So that's a real issue. And the rise in resource nationalism has definitely been a major factor. Another thing is that there's a lot of inferred resources in the Russian Far East and in China. And a lot of that stuff hasn't been drilled out and really explored. A lot of it hasn't even had geochemical or geophysical exploration done on it. But, you know, geologists look at the geology of those regions and they say there's probably enormous volumes of gold mineralized deposits that can be mined in those regions. The problem is, for the West and for mining companies and for investors in Western mining companies, those mines will be developed by Chinese companies and to a lesser extent by Russian companies. And, you know, they're not going to be listed on the TSX or the New York Stock Exchange or the London Stock Exchange. So you will see in the long run a shift in mining from, you know, North American and European listed gold mining companies to mining companies that aren't listed on Western exchanges. It's just the nature of what's happening in terms of long-term economic development.
Jeff, real quick, filtering down to the juniors, we have seen some majors fund juniors in earn-in agreements, JV agreements for certain projects. Do you see this trend continuing? And is this positive for juniors?
It is positive. We do see it continuing. It is positive for juniors. It's something that we're working on ways to find capital for junior exploration companies that isn't from larger companies. Because what happens is, you know, if a larger company is funding it, you know, they have the right to take it over. And the junior will say, thank God I've got funding because I can move forward and I don't have to be constantly wondering where my next money is coming from. But the flip side is that you don't get to run an auction process when it comes time to sell your deposit or your mining company because there's somebody who has the right to acquire it. And other companies won't bid. They say, well, so if the XYZ mining company has 9% stake in that property and they have the right to, you know, acquire 80%, I'm not going to bid for it.
That is one of the risks, and that's what we hear too, is that it does scare or shy away some other potential bidders. But hey, it is positive for juniors to have some sort of consistent funding available to them. Jeff, thank you very much for taking this time to look into what the majors are seeing for this market. Hope this all helped out some investors just to get a handle on what truly is kind of the main funding source for some of these exploration companies, how the majors are seeing the market. Jeff, thank you as always for your time. We'll probably chat next month. Hope you have a great rest of your week.
I'll be around. Take care.